Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for the weekend edition, also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and our podcast, Corlin Economics Report. Man, oh man, these weeks have been really busy, but you know what? It's a lot of fun covering all these different companies that I'm featuring on the show, and I'm seeing a lot of great feedback and all the emails that I've been getting thanking us for covering all these companies and trying to get as many questions as we can answered for all of you, all the investors out there. This weekend show, we are going to focus a lot on the precious metals sector and even drive down a lot into the stocks. I'm starting off this weekend show with Richard Postma, aka Doc. Now, Doc, it's been a little while since I had you on. I want to start with simply the gold price. And there are a couple of listeners that want me to not necessarily take you to task, but just bring up the fact that you thought gold would have a slow month of May. And boy, oh boy, it was a good month of May. Let's start there, Doc. What happened this month that didn't line up with the technicals you were watching?
Well, the when you look at the monthly chart, the 12-month MACD moved up toward the 26. So that's what happened. There was a gentle move of that. And now we're coming to June, and we'll see if what I felt in May turns out to happen in June. Because if you look at the monthly chart, it's extremely, from a pattern standpoint, very similar to the chart back in 2012 and 2013. You'll see back in 2013 on that MACD, how the 12-month moved up toward the 26-month, and then it started to move along it as far as a parallel down for a couple of months after that. And we could be set up for the same thing. And so June could turn out to be what I expected in May. But the interesting difference between now and back in 2012 and 13 is the fact that if you look at the strength indicator, such as ADX, back then, the strength indicator, the black line, which is a combination of the bullish and bearish ADX lines, moved down continuously, whereas the strength indicator this time is not on on the same slope down. It is moving down, but very gradually. It's almost moved laterally in May. It may move down a little bit in June. So that's a sign of impending strength in this market and telling you that we're not going to, at this point in time, see the kind of sell-off or double topping most likely that we saw back in 2011, 12, and 13, or 2011, 2012, which was really problematic then for a number of years.
Yeah, Doc, I'm glad that you said that we're not in another environment that is going to turn out like 2012 and 2013, because all the gold investors that were around for that time remember just how quickly the gold price fell and then was stuck in that trading range for about 6 to 7 years. That was really a painful kind of bear market and consolidation of that correction. Doc, does the fact that gold looks like it's going to close the month right around that 1900 level — we are recording this about halfway through the day on Friday, but again, gold is right at that 1900 level, it's a key resistance level — is there any significance here that just gives you a bit more thought that there is some strength here in the gold market because of the key levels that it passed through this month and is closing the month at?
Yeah, it's just another indicator that holds a lot of promise. And we're also right at that upper downtrend line of that wedge that has been forming. But we may actually close above it on Monday, which would be encouraging. But I think it's a false move unless we continue seeing the 12-month move up even to touch that 26-month moving average. Then we're going to have another decent month in June. But that's what I'm watching. And it's rare that you see on these long-term charts where it actually breaks higher right away in a downtrend. So, and it would be more positive if actually we move down for a while again in June and July and continued where we had strength in these stocks, because I think we do not see the big down move that we saw back in that previous period where we compromised the zero point on this MACD. And so, you know, it's encouraging. Another note here is we've had two higher closing months now. So we're getting into a risk here of having a closing down month, even if we would close higher in June. We could be forming a trading range that's fairly high in gold, which is another positive, because it will continue to, even if these stocks come back down, some of the ones that have had a run, they're not going to, I think, get completely decimated.
Hey, if gold can set up a trading range around the $1,900 level, I don't think anybody should be worried or arguing about that. That's a very solid level. And considering that it has just been on a two-month run, Doc, now that we're at $1,900 here, and I know even through this month, gold exceeded some of your expectations, how has that changed your lower targets and the potential here this year of gold getting back to around that $2,100 level?
The only way gold could get back to that 2100 is if the 12-month moving average on the monthly chart breaks through the 26. And I would rather see us turn down and start from lower levels, because if we do that, we're going to have a much stronger rally when the big one comes. I don't like sitting up here at these levels. You could do it for a while, but I think it would serve us better if we would drift down yet for two or three months to lower levels and then start a move up again. That would, to me, be a very powerful move. I'd be surprised to see the previous highs around 2100 taken out this year.
Doc, let's talk about the gold stocks too, because the bigger gold stocks, the royalty companies, those were leading this charge. We've even started to see some of the juniors catch on here. And one thing Jordan Royburn brought up earlier this week that I found really interesting is that the breadth in the HUI, 100% of the stocks in the HUI are over their 20-day and 50-day moving averages. And on the GDXJ, 97 are above those levels. That shows extreme breadth. What are your thoughts on the stocks here and how strong actually the big guys have been through this recovery?
What really bothers me, Corey, is how some of the juniors, however, have not performed in this move like some of the
large. It's not a broad-based recovery in the juniors.
No, it isn't. And that bothers me a little bit because I also have to wrap my mind around that, in the sense that if we get a pullback in the gold price, will they get hit even harder? I don't think so. They're already sucking a lot of wind. I don't see them going much lower. So the ones that would get hit would be the ones that have had the higher moves, actually, that would some of the good producers and some of the royalty companies. The other thing that's a little bit bothersome is the fact that a lot of these stocks have not had big volume. It doesn't look like we're getting other people back into this market yet. And except for those that are ardent supporters and knowledgeable about these precious metal stocks. And that's a little bothersome, too, that volume is starting to tail off in a lot of these companies. And that tells me that we could go quiet here and move down again a little bit. But that's okay, because in the long view of things, we're going to do fine in this market. We're in a good position. And there's also other fundamentals around us that are starting to concern me a little bit, like housing starts plummeted from April to May, and pending home sales are down now for 2 or 3 months. I think some of these housing prices are having a deleterious effect on that market, plus lumber prices dropped considerably recently. And so we're starting to see signs that if the stimulus isn't there, this so-called recovery could start to go the other way. And of course, that's positive for us because the Fed will get nervous and the government will get nervous and they'll want to print a lot more money again. So any way you look at it, our environment right now, I feel is very positive for the precious metals space.
So, Doc, you are right regarding volume in a lot of these juniors especially. It has not been skyrocketing. But one thing that is still true about the sector is there's still a lot of money being raised. And a lot of these companies are cashed up, and there's been a lot of news coming out. The best news has been bought. Broadly, though, a lot of the news is more just digesting of some of the, I guess, recent rebounds in these stocks. What do you have to say about all the companies that are cashed up, though? That does provide some more run room for these juniors and allow them to at least do more work that could cause these catalysts to move the companies forward.
That actually is a very good point, Corey, and a very big positive because it allows them not to go to the secondary market again for quite a while. And they can use, of course, this money to expand their reserves, find more product in the ground. And that to me is a considerable positive for these companies. And the gold price is high enough where the cash flows for a lot of the bigger companies is really something to watch here and is very positive and probably speaks to more acquisitions and mergers going down the road, especially if we get another sell-off here. That's another positive for the precious metals market right here.
All right, let's move over to silver quickly then, Doc. I know a lot of the technicians were watching that 1850 level for silver. Barring some sort of a huge flood of money coming into silver at the end of today, doesn't look like silver is going to close the month or this week over that 2850 level. What's your thought on silver?
Yeah, silver is struggling right here. It's I think the next couple of weeks we're going to start to trade sideways and maybe a little bit down in silver again. We may move back down to 26. That 2850 area is going to be difficult to take right out. The RSI on the weekly is positive, but when you look at the ADX. The bullish green line is starting to turn down and the red line is probably going to turn up next week. And that tells you that we may have another week up here or two a little bit, but I don't see silver taking off here and challenging the 30 area again for quite a while.
Do you see silver breaking down or is it just going to continue to trade in this range? Let's call the range low 20s up to 30s. And in all fairness, silver's been trading in the upper part of that range.
Yeah, I see silver trading between 26 and potentially 29 here next month, right in that range. I see a holding pattern right now, which is really a positive for it, frankly. But I don't see a big breakdown in silver at all here, Corey.
All right, Doc, let's also talk about the U.S. equity markets because, look, a lot of people still looking for a general rollover in these markets. The markets continue to be strong, though. I think every month this year so far, the markets are putting in a positive close. So that's something to consider, I guess, barring January, where the markets were slightly down. But either way, these markets continue to be strong. Do you see that continuing, Doc? One other thing to consider is these markets have been strong in a pretty boring nature.
Yes, they are. I mentioned about a month ago that I was concerned about the stock market from the standpoint of the monthly indicator of the MACD, which was approaching the level of 2018. If you go back historically, we have not seen the MACD at this level for more than 20 years. And I'd have to go even, I'll bet if we went back further, We haven't seen it for 30 or 40 years. And that's a real warning sign. And in fact, this month we took out the high back in early 2018. The 26-month moving average took out the 26-month moving average back then. We don't have much higher that we can go on this thing probably. And it's considerably separated from the 26. So I was concerned about May, but I'll tell you what, we're getting close to where technically this doesn't make sense anymore. And you wonder how high that momentum indicator can go. So there's real risk here. And that doesn't speak to other things like price to sales and other variables that are at probably all-time highs on this market.
Doc, does it have to make sense, though? Isn't that these markets, all the money that's going into the system and, quite frankly, little other places to go with it, seems to just keep pushing these markets higher?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense until it doesn't make sense, Corey. We watched this in the past, the tech boom back in the 90s. I can remember guys talking about how this could go on forever, and then we had a comeuppance, and there's a point where we're going to get the same thing in this market. And I really don't know what's going to do it, because they can print all the money they want to. Plus then, if these markets start to see difficulties, they can start to buy S&P futures. The Fed could do that, and just like Japan, and we become Japanified. We could play that game too. So there's all kinds of ways they can manipulate this market if they want to. So it's hard to really understand at what point this thing gives it up.
Doc, if we see some sort of a correction, everyone's predicting a correction here. Let's say that we are going to get a correction. These markets are due for a correction. What kind of correction do you see this turning out to be? Is it a level-headed correction, maybe a natural pullback, 15-20%, or is it fast? Does it turn into more of a crash?
Well, I think we could have a 20% correction, but I think what could happen is we could fall back, and then there'd be ways that they would support it, and we could just sit at these levels for 5-10 years. And not have much of a return. That would probably be the best scenario instead of a total capitulation where we go down to, let's say, 1,800 on the Dow or 18,000 on the Dow in that area, or maybe between 18,000 and 20, which is a possibility based on where we were back in 2009. And so I think what we can see is it getting hit pretty hard, and then the powers to be stepping in to support this thing, and then just maintaining it at a certain level where it just sits there for a number of years.
All right, Doc, summarize for us then where and how aggressive you have been with your portfolio, and if there are any other pockets in these markets that you think are critical to be watching for a little bit of guidance in terms of where the metals, the precious metals especially, are moving from here.
Well, I'm now, I moved from being 37% in the metals to 44%. I'm waiting for another pullback here, which, you know, would be a nice thing to see, and then I'll start buying again. I don't chase markets, and my portfolio has done very well, by the way, in spite of the fact that I'm not on a percentage basis into these stocks as much as other people. But I tend to be conservative, and when they do move viciously against me, I don't get hurt too bad. But that's just my nature of how I invest. And I'm very bullish on gold particularly. Silver could have difficulties just like any other commodities if we have a real economic downturn. But gold, based on the amount of money they printed and the monetary base, I'm very bullish long term, and have been now for 2 or 3 years. And I will continue to purchase stocks I like, especially on drawbacks. And I will stay, I'll increase my investment over time, because I really believe in this market. I think we're heading toward, you know, the one where we really get the big move.
Hey, Doc, you care to share before we wrap this up any stocks that you're interested in and that you are trading right now?
The royalty I'm in a big way, and thanks to Excelsior on this. And I do my own research, but Sandstorm, I went into that quite heavily when it was at its low. I like Equinox, which I've invested in for a long time. I'm also in, the symbol is WRN, which is copper and gold, and that's breaking out. I like that. But I'm starting to buy a lot of these juniors that have come back now because I think they show good value at these levels. I'm taking bigger positions in those right now, Corey.
Okay, Doc, great having you on the show. Thanks again for the update. I know that we'll get a lot of comments and I'll get a lot of emails on the back of this, but a lot of people wanted to hear your updated technicals. So I thank you for taking the first two segments of this weekend show. Doc, have a great rest of your weekend.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this segment, I am joined by Brian Lenny, founder and editor of the Junior Stock Review website and also editor of the premium service over at Junior Stock Review, where Brian dives into companies that he likes and shares his, what I think is some of the best research in the junior resource sector. Brian, I'm bringing you on this weekend show because I am focusing this show a bit more on the resource sector, especially on junior resource stocks. I've seen a lot of traffic come into our website just over the last number of months because of all the company interviews I've been doing throughout the week. And we're going to follow up on a company you have already brought up to our audience. That is Montage Gold, traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol MAU and on the OTC markets under the symbol MAUTF. Now, earlier on this week, May 25th, Montage announced a PEA for the Koné Gold Project that is in Côte d'Ivoire. Some of the headline numbers here: after-tax NPV of $652 million. And actually, if you bump up that, that's at $1,600 gold. If you bump up the gold price to $1,850, it's over $1 billion of after-tax NPV. An IRR at that $1,600 gold, 31%. This looks on its face here as a pretty good PEA for this Koné Gold Project. Brian, again, you followed this company for a while. What's your takeaway from this PEA?
Thanks for having me, Corey. I think it's great. I think it's even better because it surpassed my estimates, you know, going into it. And I always like to see that. I'm definitely more conservative when I put together a model or an idea estimation for a project. So for it to come out ahead, and albeit at a lower gold price at $1,600, I was very happy. And in fact, I added to my position. You know, the things that stand out to me, you know, right off the hop are the annual gold production, which I think surpassed 200,000 ounces and has a peak production over 300. And, you know, when you look around the world of undeveloped gold projects, you know, this definitely puts the Koné deposit sort of in, you know, that elite company, because, you know, even 100,000 ounces is seemingly hard to find these days. So double that capacity definitely stands out. And I think it'll stand out to those mid-tiers or maybe even some senior companies that are looking at wanting to add to their resources and mining operations in the future. So, you know, I was really happy with what has come out, and I'm looking forward to, you know, the rest of the year as they move to a feasibility study.
So, Brian, this might be hard for you to answer, but one thing that stood out to me is that, yeah, 3 million ounces of gold and average annual gold production, yeah, almost 250,000 ounces a year in the first 9 years, but the overall mine life is almost 15 years here. That's not a bad thing, but Do you know if there's any opportunity here to increase some of that throughput, maybe decrease the mine life, but push a few more ounces through each year?
You know, it'll be interesting to see. Like the infill drilling that they're doing right now includes, if I'm correct, some extensional targets. And so you might see that depending, and again, I haven't looked close enough. They haven't released the technical report to see, you know, how exactly it's going to be mined. But some of those extensions might increase early on the throughput capability, and which would be great. I think the other side to it is, you know, they're going to be drilling some of these targets in the, you know, the immediate vicinity of the Kone deposit. Petit Yao is the, you know, the best one and the one that they have some prior results on. So you could see, you know, if they can outline a sizable deposit and it makes sense, you could see these, you know, starter deposits or these smaller deposits, which seem to be much higher grade, be incorporated into the processing very early on. And again, increase that throughput, you know, in those first, you know, 8 or 9 years, which would be fantastic for the NPV. So, yeah, I think that's the big upside that could be had. That's not even included in this initial PEA, but might be part of the story come the feasibility study near the end of the year.
Well, and that's the thing, right? The feasibility study is, it sounds like, working through. I had the company on at the tail end of April to update us all, so we will be reaching back out to them. One other thing when it comes to estimated all-in sustaining costs, we're seeing during the first 3 years, this number be $835 per payable ounce, the life of mine, under $1,000 per payable ounce. What was your thought on the estimates here for all-in sustaining costs?
Oh, I think it's great. I think that $1,000 mark is a really key point to be in, especially in West Africa. And, you know, for a mainly fresh rock or sulfide deposit, I think that's, you know, an excellent area to be in. It gives lots of, you know, margin to wherever the gold price is headed. And I think it, you know, that's again another one of those points that makes this deposit stand out and is really the backbone of why the NPV is so strong. You know, it's tough to say. I think with this management team, I have a lot more confidence in this PEA, and I think that all-in sustaining cash cost is more realistic than it is maybe with some other teams. And so that I do put more stock into that value. So yeah, I do think it means a lot, and I do think it's one of those big things that stand out as a huge point and will be something that attracts the mid-tiers and the senior producers once this thing is, you know, probably through the feasibility study and is ready to have that construction decision.
So Brian, what are some of the key catalysts then that you're watching? Because the company has a lot on the go, right? Feasibility study coming up, fully funded 55,000 meter drill program. What do you think could provide that next bounce, a potential bounce to the share price?
So for me, I think the big thing is, and you know, the baseline, the reason why I'm invested in it is just purely the re-rate that I believe is going to occur as they get closer to that feasibility study. I think, you know, on the conservative side of things, I think you probably have at least a double from here, just based solely on a re-rate with getting the completion of that feasibility study. The side to that, if you want to get more forward looking, I think that if you look at Petit Yao, if they can outline a deposit here and they can show the market that, you know, let's say you have at least 100,000 ounces there and the grade is, you know, right now it looks like it's 3 or 4 grams per ton. If you can be there, you're 3 or 4 times the grade of the Kone deposit as it is at 0.8. I think, again, this is a big deal and could be that add-on to the valuation, and the market might give more recognition. Again, you know, it's a huge property. There's other targets they could go after. I don't know if that necessarily fits into this year. I have to do a follow-up conversation with Hugh and Adam. But, you know, targets like that, or, you know, those extensional infill drilling, if those extensional targets, you know, come in, and, you know, they show good grade and, you know, it's ore. Again, these are small things that could add up and catch the market's attention. And then the last part would be a bet on the gold price. I think if we entered the second leg of this gold market, which I think is probably solely hinged on gold, you know, probably getting above 1900 and staying there. I think, you know, the multiple on this, on a company like this, could be quite high even before the re-rating or any drill success, because, you know, the robustness of this PEA and the people that completed it, I think speak for themselves. These guys have good reputations. So that's kind of how I look at the possibility for share price appreciation.
So Brian, can you share with us how you're trading around this PEA? Because as we're recording this on May 27th, the stock got a little pop when the PEA came out. It was actually quite a nice pop on that day, but has since kind of faded right back to the price it was trading at even before the PEA came out.
Yeah, well, what I did is I bought more after it came back down. I really thought that we were going to see it probably go back up to at least the IPO price, which I believe was $1.10. But it came back down and I bought a tranche at 93 cents and a tranche at 91 cents. And increased my overall position by, I think it's roughly 30%. Kind of interesting that it traded like that. I think that's just, you know, a marker of where we are in the market. But again, you know, for me, I see a ton of value in just holding this company into its feasibility study. And I think the market's going to recognize it. I think that, you know, those people that have bought in this area are going to be really happy, you know, come 6 months from now when that feasibility study is released.
All right. Well, Brian, we're going to wrap it up there. I hope this shed some light on a story that hopefully a lot of our audience is following, because I have had the company on the show before and you've outlined them. And now this was a pretty big PEA as the company just continues to move forward with this project. So if anybody has any follow-up questions for Brian or for the team over at Montage, as always, be sure to email me, fleck@kereport.com. Brian, I appreciate your time on this weekend show. Again, go check out Brian's website, juniorstockreview.com. Brian, we'll chat again next week. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks for having me, Corey.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're going to shift a little bit away from the precious metals sector, especially as I am chatting with Mark Chandler. He is a managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also writes the Mark to Market blog. Mark, I want to start off with your assessment, your recap of the month of May, the moves that we saw in the markets, the moves that we saw in any particular sectors, because overall, I think the month of May was pretty good for investors. If you were invested, let's say outside of the US dollar, which had a bit of a downtrend, there was a lot of positive moves to the upside. What's your takeaway from the month that is pretty much wrapping up thanks to the long weekend here in the US?
Yeah, what an incredible month, huh? I mean, you know, the U.S. yield softened, the dollar stayed under pressure, but the U.S. stock market, not really necessarily the leader. The Europe's Dow Jones Stocks 600, which is sort of like the U.S. S&P 500, hit record highs. Chinese saw money return into the stock market for the first time in several months. So I think that it was really the month of really risk-taking, and this kept U.S. yields low and kept the dollar under pressure. I kind of marvel, though, at some patterns in the market. Where what caught my eye in the FX market was sterling. It was the strongest of the major currencies, up 2.7% in the month. And what's remarkable about it is that that there's some seasonal patterns, and sterling has fallen the last 11 years against the dollar in May. And not only did it reverse it this month, but it also is the strongest of the majors. And I think what's driving this is sort of the couple of the key drivers of the major capital flows right now, and that is playing for the recovery. The UK's vaccination, economy reopening seems to be ahead of most countries and many countries. And the Bank of England, like the Bank of Canada, said in April about reducing the bond buying. So everybody loves sterling now. And yesterday, so the second last day of the trading for the month for us, sterling actually closed at three-year highs above 142. It couldn't sustain it ahead of the weekend, did some profit taking, but sterling's got a lot of momentum.
So, Mark, what about when it comes to the U.S. markets? The whole adage of sell in May and go away really turned on its head last year, especially when no one could go away. This year, though, the U.S. especially is starting to open up. Even Europe, there's a lot more traveling going on. Do you think that we are entering this seasonally slow period of time?
Well, it's possible. I still think that things haven't really fully opened up yet. A lot of the same drivers that lifted us last year seem to still be at work. I think people are playing more of the recovery type stocks. And that's why I think, you know, here we are, NASDAQ is actually down this month, losing about 1%, while it's really been the Dow. So I think that what some people might see is another opportunity to play for value over growth. That might be that switch, that rotation taking place. I see this in some of the plays in the airlines. You know, the reopening up of the U.S. for domestic travel has been very strong, and I can just see the traffic patterns. So perhaps this year is a repeat more of last year, where liquidity-driven expectations of stronger economic growth help lift risk assets, including equities.
So it could just continue to be pretty good for these markets then, hey? Because of how much liquidity is out there and, quite frankly, nowhere else to put it, these markets, you think, still have some upside?
Well, I mean, Europe's at record highs. Asia's not far from it, like, say, the MSCI Asia Pacific. And I think that as economies strengthen, I think, you know, it's remarkable in some ways. You know, a year ago, we had generally weak economies and strong stocks. And this year, we've had stronger economies, and yet the stock markets are really holding up pretty well. I have the S&P up about 12.2% this year, and say the German DAX up about 13%. It looks to me like the real laggard, besides the NASDAQ, as you would expect, is Asia, which is also very tech-heavy. You know, the Chinese have an index, the CSI 300, and that is up only 2% year-to-date. And so maybe the game or the play might not be so much focused on the U.S. and Europe, which have already had the moves, but maybe looking at Asia, which has really lagged behind.
Okay, something to consider, I guess, as we move into the main part of summer. Mark, what about next week? What are some of the key catalysts, some of the key news events that you're going to be watching to kick off June for us?
Sure. So I think four big things on my radar screen for next week. One is the Reserve Bank of Australia's meeting on June 1st. That's important because last week the Reserve Bank of New Zealand surprised the market and was more hawkish than many people expected. They didn't change rates or anything, but they did hint at the possibility of raising rates in the second half of next year. So the New Zealand dollar shot up. And even though the Australian economy is many times larger than New Zealand, many people see the two of them, agriculture or commodity countries and currencies linked, monetary policy, many people perceive as linked. But I think the RBA has already indicated that this June meeting is not really in play. The key one is the July meeting. We will decide about whether to extend the quantitative easing or to slow it down, and also whether they continue to target the three-year yield at 10 basis points. Besides the RBA meeting, the other kind of interesting meeting is going to be the G7 finance ministers meeting. It'll be face-to-face for the first time in over a year. And the key issue here really is about taxation and about coordinating corporate taxes. The Biden administration has jumped aboard asking for it now, compromising to 15% minimum tax rate for corporations. This seems to be have pretty strong support within the G7, but the other element is how do you tax? What do you do about the digital tax that many countries want to put on because they see U.S. companies especially making sales in their country, but that country cannot tax that income. And so the U.S. has proposed taxing the top 100 companies globally. And that would help. That would bring in these U.S. digital companies, address that concern, but bring in other companies as well. So it's not just picking on U.S. companies. So that's the G7 meeting, finance ministers meeting. And then two pieces of economic data. One is the Eurozone CPI. The They'll be the first look at May. And the important thing here is how it feeds into the ECB's decision on June 10th, whether to continue to the increase in bond buying that they announced in March or whether to scale it back a bit. And this is, and partly the inflation number is going to feed into that debate. And the last piece of economic data of note here is the U.S. jobs data. Remember last month's big disappointment? The median forecast was almost 1 million, and we got about 1/4 of that. The early call this time is about 600,000. And so that could help keep ideas, strengthen ideas of that the U.S. economy itself is very robust despite some weak economic data really throughout the month of May. Canada also releases the jobs data. And there I'm concerned that the Canadian dollar, many of us may have gotten a little bit in front of our skis here in the sense that the market, the speculative market in the futures, has the biggest long Canadian dollar position in about 4 years. The market's pricing in 3 rate hikes by the end of 2022. And this could sort of like hit a reality that maybe the Canadian economy a bit slower with the vaccine rollout, slower to open up and reinvigorate. And we could see the second month in a row of job losses in Canada. And I would expect that would prompt the Bank of Canada to sound maybe somewhat less hawkish than they did in April, which had signaled or triggered almost a 4.5% rally in the Canadian dollar.
Honestly, I would be shocked if Canada somehow manages to add jobs during this month, because quite frankly, stuff was shutting down, right? So I don't know. Somehow Canada has, though, surprised in terms of that data, taking into account the Reserve Bank of Australia, their meeting, and also the data that could come out of Canada. Sounds like you might see some weakness on the back of both of these news events, I guess. Anything that you're carrying over to commodity moves then? Because these are very commodity-focused currencies.
Yes, I think I'd be watching what China does. China had signaled that commodity prices had gotten too far, or too high. And so they've taken, it's really kind of interesting that rather than take like very strong overt measures, they're really doing micro issues, making like trying to crack down on regulations that they can close a blind eye to sometimes, as far as maybe illegal mining or unauthorized mining is a better way to put it. I'd be watching what China does with commodities, but you can see what's happening elsewhere too. I mean, that the commodity complex has gotten, there's more disparity or more like a divergence within it. I'm thinking about gold going above $1,900 an ounce this past week. I see lumber prices look like they've rolled over, though it's hard to tell because it's still so volatile. So I'm watching these as a sign that maybe the commodity super cycle story has played itself out and went for a corrective phase led by the signals from China.
That's very interesting. How long could this correction be for the commodity space? Because in all fairness, it has been a very strong run, and there's a lot of people talking about this being a commodity super cycle.
Yeah, I don't know. I think so much, it always scares me. So much, it seems to me at some point we have to just think about how much is priced in, how good can good be? And as much as it looks like it's true, trees don't really grow to the sky. And so I think the same kind of thing in the markets that I just want to be watching more carefully those macro fundamentals. Growth is, U.S. numbers have disappointed. China, we're going to get the Chinese PMI for May in the next few days. And it doesn't look like their economy is really accelerating. And so, yes, there's going to be some catch-up with Europe, catch-up in Asia. But I worry that we've really like projected a lot more than seems reasonable in the near term.
Okay, Mark, final comments. And regarding that G7 meeting, the minimum corporate tax or how to tax the top 100 companies, will this have an impact if something is passed on the largest companies, the companies that, in all fairness, can drive markets to a greater degree than anything else?
Well, that's a good point. I keep an eye on Ireland, which is not a member of the G7. It's not part of the G20 caucus yet. Its 12.5% corporate tax rate draws a lot of pharmaceutical companies and technology companies to use Ireland as sort of the center, the financial center where profits can be booked and other tax maneuvering. And Ireland does not want any part of this global minimum tax that's above their current tax rate. I think that countries have to figure out how to compete. It's a very competitive world. And some countries like Ireland can compete on taxes. It doesn't make sense necessarily for all countries to do that. I think there's an effort to try to avoid a race to the bottom. My point of caution would be this, that there's a big difference between the tax schedule and the effective tax rate. So, for example, while the U.S. corporate tax rate was around, we had cut it to 21%, the effective U.S. tax rate on U.S. corporates, the effective, was closer to 16%. And so we just want to be careful of making sure that tax reform doesn't turn out to be a new boondoggle for lawyers and accountants to figure out new ways to work around them.
Yeah, well, let's see how that all plays out, though, right, Mark? Well, Mark, we're going to wrap up the weekend edition here. It's great having you on the show. I hope everybody enjoyed that first hour, really focused on precious metals, but then also here recapping what to pay attention to for next week. Everybody, keep the emails coming, fleck@kereport.com. I love hearing from all of you. I do my best to get back to all of you, and especially when it comes to company questions. I am out there trying to source all that information for you and get you more a comprehensive answer and outlook from a number of my favorite guests. So, hey, keep those emails coming. And everyone down in the U.S., I hope you have a great long weekend. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.